Welcome to another episode of The Gateway. My name is Russ, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts Amin and Biagio. For this episode, The Gateway is excited to welcome Dr. David J. Gunkel. David is an award-winning educator, researcher, and author specializing in the philosophy of technology with a focus on the moral and legal challenges of artificial intelligence and robots. He is the author of over 115 scholarly articles and has published 17 books, including The Machine Question, Critical Perspectives in AI, Robots, and Ethics, Of Remixology, Ethics and Aesthetics After Remix, Person, Thing, Robot, A Moral and Legal Ontology for the 21st Century and Beyond, and Handbook on the Ethics of AI. He currently holds the position of Presidential Research Scholarship and Artistry Professor in the Department of Communication at Northern Illinois University. David, welcome to The Gateway. It is a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So I'm thoroughly excited. I always love these conversations, especially when it comes to communication technology. This is what we're all about. And I think you're the perfect person to give us even more context. But before we get into all of that, I like to start these conversations at the beginning and learn more about how you got to where you are today. What's your story?
Yeah, it's an interesting story because this is my plan B. My plan A actually was to be an astronaut.
Okay.
I actually, unlike a lot of people of my era who had that goal in mind, I actually got kind of close. I went to the Naval Academy and I was in the flight training program. And I washed out of that because of a botched physical where the doctor diagnosed me with something I didn't have. And as a result, they canceled my plan to get into the command module. And so I left the Naval Academy and went off to find other things to do. And this is where it landed me.
That sounds kind of heartbreaking in a little bit. Like that had to be a little bit of a difficult time for you to deal
lucky,
with that. Go ahead.
Lucky for us for NIU. Thank you for that, doctor.
Yeah. It was one of those things. I was a 19-year-old and I'm being evaluated by a superior commanding officer, and I'm not going to question his diagnosis. So I didn't even get a second opinion until after I left. And a civilian doctor saw me and said, no, you don't have this thing.
Again, I'll reiterate what it means that I think we're lucky to have you. And I think all things happen for a reason. But when you're going through those, sometimes it's hard to identify the reason. And now that you have some perspective, I hope you feel like you're where you belong. So with all of that being said, what was that transition like? Because when you're going Naval Academy, when you're doing that, that's a pursuit in someone's life. And then switching to academics to where you are today. What was that transition like for you?
I'd want to say that I had this really great plan and I just executed it and it worked out brilliantly. It was more like bumping around in the dark until you found like some place that, didn't resist you and you could actually make it work for you. So, I think everyone's path is rocky. And we all kind of find our way. I like to say to my students, I succeeded through failure and I just failed my way to the top.
I think that's a good mentality to have, especially when you want to have a specific path and the next step laid out in front of you. And then you realize I just need to keep going and see where it ends. So now I want to kind of pivot to where you're at now, and you're referencing your students and your biography, your background is incredible. But for you as a normal day-to-day person, what's getting you up in the morning? Is it that research? Is there something that you're still trying to discover or find out? What's that motivation for you on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm currently acting department chair, and I'd like to say that what gets me motivated is that when I wake up every morning, there's a set of fires I have to put out.
Thank you.
That is not what motivates me to get out of bed. What actually motivates me to get out of bed is writing. I like to write. And because the research I do is more philosophically oriented, I don't have research that I do in a laboratory and then go away and write up the results. The writing is actually the research. And it's not even that I have like all these things I want to say to the rest of the world. It's that I write to figure out what the hell I'm thinking about things. And so what gets me out of bed is this sort of curiosity to try to figure out something that I'm puzzling through. And the method by which I figure that out is by writing, engaging in the process of actually sitting down and taking 4 or 5 hours to write every day.
Wow. Yeah. Do you then have to, is there a point when you look at your writing and say, I'm going to use this as a tool for brainstorming and to kind of get my thinking or my logic, whatever term you want to use in that one, kind of just a better structure and an understanding on your side of things? Or yeah, is it always just, I've already outlined where I'm at and I'm ready to draft and have it published publicly with no efforts or no edits? Because that's what all the students expect, right? Like, that's right. Why
everyone expects that you have this idea in your head, and then the writing is the expression of that idea. And this
right
goes back to Aristotle. This is Aristotle's notion of semiology, right? It's an ideology that is as false as all ideologies. It doesn't really work that way. I oftentimes don't know what I'm writing, why I'm writing, or where it's going. The text, in a sense, has a mind of its own, and it leads me. I rarely feel like I'm in control of the writing. I think the writing is in control of me, and I'm just serving it. And it sort of just leads me from one thing to another. And I would say, you know, doing this for now almost 30 years every single day, 90% of the stuff I write is absolute crap. But if you do it often enough, those 10% of the time add up, and you eventually get something that not only makes sense to you, but that other people find valuable. And that's when it's rewarding.
So 4 to 5 hours is a lot, and you probably produce a lot of written work. How do you manage it? How do you organize it? How do you classify it? You must have a system by now.
My system is really somewhat basic. It is get up, and before you even begin to think about what you're going to do, start writing.
Okay.
So I just get out of bed and plop myself right in front of the computer and start immediately scribbling away. And some days it's a real slog. I mean, some days you start writing and you're like, oh God, this is horrible. This is going nowhere. And I persist because eventually sometimes I find my way through that, but it isn't very rewarding. There's other days when you start this process and then you look up and it's like, oh my God, it's 11:30. Like, where did the time go? Because it just carries you along. And that's when it's really enjoyable. I think it's like long distance running, right? When you're running, I used to run. My knees are shot now, so I can't. But I used to run long distances. And there's sometimes when you're running, when you're very aware of the process of the running and the pain in your knee, and it's just like, oh, this is horrible. I don't want to do this. And there's other times where you just sort of lose yourself in the run and it just carries you along. And I think writing works the same way.
I mean, that's very interesting. Like, I, as an academic, and I think one of the most difficult things in my job when I do research is not like getting the data, analyzing the data, but it's actually writing what is in my brain and putting into words that also other people will understand. And so the fact that you find the time and the dedication to do every day 4 or 5 hours makes me realize maybe I'm doing all wrong, because that's probably why I'm not good at writing like I would like to be able to do. Probably it's just a matter of exercising, and as you say, if you write every day 4 or 5 hours, then that 10% there is something valuable. But instead I wait until I've done all the analysis, and then I put it into words what is in my brain. Yeah, so do you I mean, I know you don't do that type of research, but do you think that will help anybody to write better? The fact that doing it constantly every day as a kind of an exercise, or not?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think writing every day is very valuable. Just because if you're doing it every day, it no longer is special. You no longer wait for the inspiration to happen, which again is a myth. It doesn't happen. It's more perspiration, like Edison would say, than inspiration. But I recognize there's different research methodologies and different fields and disciplines that do things differently. And you have to sort of figure out within your particular discipline and within your field what makes sense for you in terms of that practice. I tell my students also, I mean, I get up early, I work early, but it wasn't always that way. When I was a graduate student, I got up late. I got up late and I worked late, right? And I discovered in my own sort of process that the stuff I wrote late at night, I thought was really great when I wrote it. Kind of like when you write when you're high, like you think it's really great when you read it in the morning. It's like, oh, what was I thinking? Same thing with writing late. I just was never able to get things that in the morning look good. So I changed and I started to write in the morning. But everybody's got to figure that out. And again, it's not the kind of thing you figure out in a sort of cognitive way by saying, well, what do I prefer? It's sort of like you throw yourself into the process, and then in the manner by which you do it, you find out what is going to be the path of least resistance. And really, you should follow the path of least resistance. If it resists you, there's a reason it's resisting you. And you got to figure out, how to get around that resistance.
So I wonder, as someone that is winding down a path as you're writing, and I apologize if this is completely ignorant, and I don't mean to go down here, but when you're kind of trying to figure out a thought on more of a philosophical nature, do you end up delving into fiction and what you I guess I've always wondered that within philosophers. At some point, Aristotle thought of this stuff and said, hey, we're going to try it. Like, let's do this. This is where it is until it's disproven. How do you, as a modern day academic, someone looking at this one, find that balance of this is real, this is reality, and I'm defining that objectively, or I'm making stuff up and maybe some people will align with it. But I'm saying that in a joking sense, but there is a little bit of reality there that a song can be all fiction, but people have a real connection to it because of the sentiment and the emotion. So how do you, as someone kind of exploring that on a very defined, we're looking for truth, we're looking to advance research and human knowledge, human experience, how do you balance that? Or is that something that I'm just making up?
No, it's a really good question. I think two things in particular. One is you don't know if it's going to work or if it's going to lead to something until you actually do it. It's kind of like looking at the forest and saying, I wonder if I can get through the forest. Well, yeah, but if you only stand at the entryway to the forest, you'll never know. So sometimes you have to throw yourself into it and yeah, you get through it. And other times you have to turn around and come back because you realize this isn't going anywhere and I'm not doing anything with this. So it's very practical in that way and very pragmatic. But I also think we're not alone. Most of the thoughts we have, somebody else has thought something very similar to what we've thought. I mean, we like to think we're all original and innovative and we have these brand new ideas. But the fact is a lot of the work we do is less like the sort of singer-songwriter who, out of the inspiration of their genius, gives you a brand new song. And it's more like a DJ, right? We're just remixing deep cuts from our culture. We're crate diving and we're, putting together like a hip hop DJ does, all these different. And so sometimes you got to test your beat and see if the beat you have is the right beat. You test your melody, see if it's the right melody. And so it means a lot of reading, it means a lot of searching for previous publications. The good news is that things like Google and Bing and even some of the large language models now are really useful tools for locating where these things have been thought. And it's oftentimes not in your discipline, right? It might be somebody in the field of adult education or somebody in physics or something. But if you've got the right keywords and you just start playing around with them and what I call crate diving, it's digital crate diving. You're just looking for, who's been sort of poking around in this area prior to you. And then you can use them and their work to kind of test what you're puzzling through. And oftentimes you find like really nice samples, like quotations that you can mm-hmm. drop in that like really open up some new avenues for you.
You segued right into the perfect transition of artificial intelligence, large language models, all of the different tools that we're coming across and getting more familiar with as a society. Writing is one of the largest areas that is impacted by this. And as someone who yes. has made a career out of writing and thinking and being as original or shaping things in a novel way, does that scare you? Like, are you concerned that all the thoughts are going to be able to be prompt generated and then someone like yourself is just going to synthesize or summarize what AI has done and that's your next five publications and you get to retire and say, I'm great? Like,
I'll respond to it in two ways. One by analogy and then one more directly. The by analogy response is this. So I'm a drummer. And when drum machines, especially sampling drum machines, got to be much more capable, people were like, well, aren't you worried that you're going to be replaced by a sampling drum machine? Well, it didn't happen, right? We now have different kinds of music. Some of it uses sampled drum machine beats. Some of it uses human drummers. Some of it uses a hybrid where mm-hmm. the human drummer is playing along with a sampled beat that is sequenced or something, right? So we've changed the way that we think about the production of percussion and who mm-hmm. is doing that work. I think the same is for writers. If we try to look at the large language model and say, well, it's going to replace human writers, I think that's kind of asking the wrong question and it's looking in the wrong place. It's not about replacement. It's more about the way it's going to displace certain tasks that human writers do and reorganize the activity in a way that opens up some new opportunities. And let me give you mm-hmm. a more direct way of getting a hold of that. I think one of the biggest impediments for people writing, especially students, is the anxiety that is faced in front of the white page, mm-hmm. right? You got the blank sheet of paper and you're supposed to write. And for most people, it's that just getting started part that is the biggest hurdle in the entire process. Usually, once you are 2-3 pages into the writing, you know where you're going, you know what it's all about, and you can follow through and build your argument or tell your story, whatever the case is. But it's the getting started that I think for a lot of people is really petrifying. And I have students that will tell me, you know, I spent an entire weekend staring at a blank screen. And, mm-hmm. you know, that doesn't do them any good. It doesn't do us any good. And I think the large language model can serve us very well in overcoming the blank page. We can get it to start to generate something. And even if it's hallucinated garbage, in our mm-hmm. process of fixing it, in our process of responding to it and saying, oh, this is absolute bullshit. It should be this. And when you start doing that, now you're writing. Now you're actually putting something on the page. And I think one of the problems that we face in the university now is we're trying to figure out what to do with large language models in our classes and with our students. And I think prohibition is probably the worst approach. Saying thou shall not use this thing doesn't work. It didn't work for Wikipedia. It's not going to work for large language models. We should use these things, but we have to show them by not only what we say, but what we do, the best practices for using them and where they can actually serve us and help us do really good work.
I 100% agree. We have talked about that here so much. And I think this adds, this aligns very well with our arguments that we present our listeners. I think, as long as we make people responsible for the text they present and they claim is their own, then I think we are good enough if they produce that text by originally or if they produce that text by using a first draft generator and things like that. And especially this becomes important where there is no technical way, there is no technological way to actually detect automatic generated text. Correct. So then it's actually, we don't have a choice. We can't, we just need to say, if you let your hallucinating model write something wrong and you present it to us as your own, you're responsible for that thing being wrong. And another concern comes here is the reduced amount of written original text by humans. So that, do you have a concern that that might happen? Because people, do you think, let me refine my question. Do you think as a result of large language models, people will actually write less?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And again, I think we can get some perspective and context for it by looking at previous innovations in information and communication technology. So at one point, we were concerned that we would have a digital technology that would make it less, a Brazilian Czech theorist named Vlem Flusser had this book called Does Writing Have a Future? In which he worries about the future of writing because we have all these digital ways of creating content. Why would anybody write anything anymore? Wouldn't they just present videos and do, you know, little models in VR and things like this? Well, mm-hmm. You know, the internet didn't get rid of writing. If anything, it made writing more important as the writing became digitized and available on that platform. So I think it is a, you know, it's never the same from one innovation to the next. But I think knowing that we've dealt with these kinds of questions before and that we've had solutions to them that made the outcomes less dire, less problematic, I think for us should build some confidence that we can learn from our history how we can adjust to a future like the large language model and things like that. Although you did mention one thing that I think is important that we recognize. If we are only taking large language model generated text and then putting those out into the ether of the internet, mm-hmm. the next iteration, the next training of large language models will be on large language model generated text, not generated text. And I think that could create a situation where you are reaching diminishing returns with the capabilities of your large language models, which is why I think it's very crucial that it be not a situation where the human is replaced by the algorithm, but where we have hybridity, where the human and the algorithm are working together, and that the final text that is produced is as much a product of the human intervention as it is the contribution of the algorithm. But how and whether that will occur, you know, is something we have to be, I think, protective of, because the alternative there is that we pollute the training data with large language generated text.
Especially if you think about their objective function. Their objective function is to minimize the distinguishability between generated text and human text. And if there is generated text on both sides, then that's completely useless. That data, that optimization function loses its meaning. So I think it is actually in huge interest of these companies, the companies that develop these models, that they have access to genuinely human written text for their future iterations. And interestingly enough, the only companies that can detect the text that is generated by their models is the same company that trained that model. That's correct. The only valid model, because they have the adversary model that they train their generative model with. And that adversary model is the only one that can truly detect. So they might go out and have a consortium of these, let's put together our adversarial models and find genuine text to train the next iteration, which then we can regulate them and say, you have to publish those so that everyone can distinguish. But that's another idea.
No, it's a very good idea. But I also think not only if it's only in term of regulation, I think, you know, you get a lot of pushback on that. But I think it's important to emphasize that it's in their best interest.
Yes.
To train their models on genuine, in quotation marks, human tech. Because if their model reaches this point of diminishing returns, they have a commercial product they put a lot of money into that is not going to perform as well as the previous model and will even degrade over time. So it's not only in our interest, it's actually in their interest. And I think we have to make sure that they recognize that we can approach this as a win-win circumstance and not a, we're going to regulate you and you know, it becomes a struggle.
Yeah.
David, your responses are kind of like make my brain go in two different directions. So I don't know which path should we go next. But on one side, I was thinking you mentioned LLM, and I know you just had a great workshop about LLM, and I wanted to ask you more about it. But on the other side, I'm also thinking still about the writing and generative AI, because again, you are prolific writer, you have multiple books and articles, right? And you dedicate time to writing and every day, 4 or 5 hours. But I think the people that are listening to us and even me don't spend as much time as you in writing every day. And maybe we didn't understand the value of writing as much as you did. So as in the past, like new generation, for example, over rely on calculators, right? Which was the other thing. Like you have to do math by hands and don't use calculator. Now I see the difference between me learning how to do that math and be able to do that, and maybe the younger generation over relying on them. I'm thinking with generative AI, are we gonna lose what people perceive as the value of writing even more, just because it's gonna be so much easier to write by just saying to ChatGPT, hey, this is something I want to talk about. Can you help me starting with it or not? Right.
Yeah, no, again, I think let me answer two ways. One is, again, with a sort of historic context. So Plato wrote this dialogue called the Phaedrus. I don't know if you know it, but in the Phaedrus, there is a debate at the end of the dialogue about the then new technology that is invading Athens and worrying everyone because it's a disruptive new technology. And that new technology is writing. And so for the ancient Greeks, which were an oral culture, writing was seen as being something that was dangerous and something that was going to destroy their culture. And the reason was is that when you can write things down, you don't have to remember things anymore. You can offload your memory into the paper. And in oral culture, memory is everything. And the people who are highly valued are the poets who can remember these very long epic poems and recite them, you know, verbatim. And so there's this worry that is expressed by Socrates in the dialogue about how writing is going to ruin the minds of the young people and they won't practice their memories. Well, we figured out writing and we didn't stop using our memories, but we used our memories maybe in different ways. Mm-hmm. Better reasons. And we used writing to do what writing does well and our memories to do what our memories do well. And so again, I think historically we can look at this as a way of confronting these new challenges with some confidence, saying, you know, we've been here before and we've been able to figure out how to negotiate these opportunities and these challenges and to have good outcomes. Now it's taken hundreds of years to, you know, get to the point where we can sort of look back on these things and say, okay, I don't worry about writing anymore. We're only 2 years out from ChatGPT. So it's very early. And so a lot of the hyperbole and a lot of the hype is really the result of us not having a lot of experience with these things. And I think we will figure it out, but it's going to take, you know, again, numerous years, decades, maybe even a century for us to figure this stuff out. But it also means that we've got to be intelligent about how we integrate these tools into our classroom. If we just gave our students a calculator and said, you don't have to learn math anymore, it would be very irresponsible of us as mathematics teachers. I think if you do the same with the large language models and say, okay, here's a large language model, you don't have to learn to write anymore, I think we'd be in a very similar circumstance. And I think just as the mathematicians have had to figure out a way to integrate the tool of the calculator into the classroom, now we're going to have to figure out a way to integrate the tool of the large language model into the writing curriculum and into the foreign language curriculum and all the other places where the large language model is being seen as a threat or a crisis.
So I've been playing with some of that and the ideas and trying to balance the what's mine, what can I claim credit for, what, I mean, at the end of the day, that is a lot of what at least Western society is what's mine, what can I sell, what can I make money off of, and what is something that belongs to everyone and isn't as personally beneficial, but maybe from a societal side of things. Right. Do you find us walking into more of a, I don't know, an open culture in that sense, that now we have these tools that can answer questions broader. And I mean it in both a traditional coding, like open source tools, but also from more of a philosophical side of things, that we're all going to be more willing to exchange those ideas and know that, well, all of them, like, could you envision a point where all peer-reviewed journals have some type of AI assistance in them, and it is just assumed that, yes, it was utilized, the blank page was defeated by AI, and now this is something that is backed in real data, in all of those different things that we base it on? Or are we going to maybe shy away from that and say, like you see in art spaces, that no technology was used. It was me and a paintbrush, and that's it. And we almost give more credit to that. Do you see what, or is this, again, a weird thought that I'm only having?
No, it's a really good question. Okay. Let's start by talking about journals. I think right now you're seeing some interesting experimentation going on in academic journals. So Springer's Nature put out a statement recently that said, thou shalt not ever use generative AI for us to publish, and you can't credit an AI as an author, and have this very strict human-only content disclaimer in their editorial policy. You have other journals like this journal Robonomics, which now has a special section in the journal for AI-generated academic papers.
Oh, wow.
And so where one has gone very conservative, the other one has said, okay, let's go the other direction and see what we get as a result. And so I see this as a time of really interesting experimentation that's going on. Now, is it going to remain that way forever? No, I think we're going to eventually figure out ways of reaching a middle point that recognizes that, yes, indeed, there are ways in which we can collaborate with these algorithms to do our work. And if that's the case, there may be places and times at which crediting the algorithm as co-creator might even be feasible. There is a academic in Queensland, Australia, by the name of, what's his name? Hang on. His name is Manny Rainier. And Perfect. He is making a series of children's books using a large language model to co-create with him in these children's books. And he's also writing academic papers in which he reflects on the process of doing this, and then uses that as a sort of platform from which to credit the algorithm as a co-creator or a... And he has gotten a whole lot of pushback from the journals where he's tried to publish this, mainly because he has listed the algorithm as a co-author alongside five or six human co-authors.
Mm-hmm.
But I see us moving in a direction where this becomes no longer the exception and becomes something that we have to entertain very seriously as not only novelists, but academics, scientists, and musicians are all now experimenting with this kind of co-creation idea. What else was I going to say? You had something else in there. About who owns stuff.
Yes.
This gets into intellectual property.
Yep.
And who is it that holds the right to a piece of writing or a patent or some other piece of intellectual content? And again, we find this moment of experimentation going on right now. There is this lawyer named Brian Abbott, who is going around to different jurisdictions across the world and trying to file a patent application on behalf of an AI. The AI is called Dabis, and it has invented a food storage system that looks like a kind of Tupperware. And he has been unsuccessful in the US and the UK, mainly because in the US and the UK, you have to be a natural born person, i.e. a human being, to be an inventor. He's been successful in Australia and South Africa, where you don't need to be a naturally born person to be an inventor. So a corporation could be an inventor in these jurisdictions. And again, we're seeing ways in which human law is butting up against technological innovation. Some legal jurisdictions are preventing this because of the way the law is written. Other jurisdictions are permitting it because of the way the law is written. And you can bet as soon as we get into some sort of contentious argument about who owns what here. The side that is representing the AI is going to venue shop and file the lawsuit in the right venue where they have the best chance of being represented more equitably or more justly, as the case may be. But I think the big philosophical question here is, it asks us to reflect on what we mean by intellectual property. Like, if I create a song like Led Zeppelin did in the 1960s, that sounds like another band's song, and we don't necessarily recognize it, we're borrowing from the culture out of which we come, right? And the new things are always repurposed old things. And I think this is the big sort of insight from Remix. Kirby Ferguson has a really great documentary called Everything is a Remix, in which he argues that every act of innovation is really, you know, appropriating, recombining, and, you know, changing things up to take the old and make it into the new. And so a lot of rock and roll sounds like blues from the 1930s and 40s. A lot of hip hop sounds like rock and roll from the 60s and the 80s, right? So we got this thing going on where we're constantly borrowing from ourselves. And so is the intellectual property held by the culture? And what would that mean? Or is it held by individuals? And I think because our legal systems have been very much centered on the individual and his or her rights, intellectual property was assigned to individuals. But we may be in a circumstance here where things are more open, as you said, where we have to look at the co-ownership of some of this content across diverse communities, diverse cultures, and it's not just belonging to one individual.
I think these debates are going to be vast, and I am not quite sure we as a society have really grasped what that will look like in all of these different facets. Yeah. As someone who is an expert in communication and has kind of explored all of those different elements and is continuing to be on the cutting edge of thinking within communication, more and more, we're getting accustomed to hearing artificial voices. And I don't mean that as in a metaphor. I mean that as like, these are artificially generated sounds that speak to us. And whether it's Instagram, TikTok, whatever it is, it's that weird voice that you hear and it just reads the transcript. And we're getting more accustomed to that. Do you see that as being something diminishing when we look back at like the oral tradition and being able to pass our stories down? Or is that something that's going to allow more voices to be heard, even if they all sound the same?
Yeah, no, another really good question. And I think the reason why, on the one hand, we're very excited about these things, but also on the other hand, extremely worried about these things, is that we have, since ancient times, described ourselves as what the Greeks would say is zoon logon echon, the animal with language. That's the thing that made us unique. That's human exceptionalism in a single sentence. We are the animal with language. And for millennia, this had worked very well for us. And then we started to bump up against challenges to this exceptionalism. I think the first place we bumped up against it is when we realized that maybe animal noises aren't just noises, that maybe whales have a language, that maybe bees have a language, and that this unique skill or trait of the human being might not be as limited to the human, and it might be something shared by other animals, and not just other mammals, also insects in some cases. I think the next sort of way in which this has been threatened, or at least challenged, is with machines that talk. The first one was Eliza, right? It was a text-based machine that talked. But then, you know, we got other chatbots, and we got Alexa, and we got Siri. And now we have these synthetic voices that are generating all kinds of things that sound remarkably close to what we would expect from a human vocal performance. I think probably the most interesting one is the new Notebook LM from Google, where you can feed in a PDF and it produces a podcast.
Yeah.
I took one of my books and I fed it into Notebook LM, and it made a 7-minute podcast where a female and male participant argued about my book. It was actually
Was it good? Was it coherent? Like, as writer of it, did it make relative sense?
It made a lot of sense.
You're like, I wish my students understood it as well as they.
Yeah, no. In fact, I've said this before to my students, and I use it as a kind of joke, but it's no longer a joke. I think some of my best readers are the AIs. and this was a really good sort of demonstration of that. So I think that is one reason why we're very concerned about this. On the other hand, I think it does open some new ways of thinking about oral communication beyond this sort of limitation that we've had to human beings and what we do as human beings. And I'm just thinking of my students, for example. If you give them a really long text, again, it's sort of like a blank page problem. They look at how thick the book is and it's like, oh God, I'm not going to read this. If you had a 7-minute podcast that laid out for them some of the big landmasses in that book, and they got interested in that, they may be more welcoming of the big book. They might want to say, hey, I want to know more about that. And then we can lead them from that into the big book and say, hey, on page 100, that thing that caught your attention in the podcast is really spelled out in greater detail. And you can, you know, learn more about it and, you know, read 20, 25 pages or whatever the case is. So I think there's ways in which, again, you know, we can see the threat and it's obviously something that makes people uncomfortable, but we can also see opportunity that we have to learn how to integrate and intelligently, deploy.
Dr. Gungo, I want to push on that real fast because I like the idea of having, it almost lowers the anxiety or the fear of what I'm getting into, whether it's a class and I'm looking at all 4 books that I'm going to have to read in the next 16 weeks to be able to synthesize it and say, okay, I think I understand. And now I know what I'm looking for. We're also a drive-through society. We're a soundbite society. I'd much rather hear the quip that I can remember and move on. And my argument is done and I win and you lose and we're done with that.
Perfect.
Are we, as we maybe use those tools more, when do we lose that understanding of committing to something and fully digesting that as ourselves and saying, I'm going to read a 200-page book and maybe there will be one other person in my life that actually has done that and I can connect with it, but I'm not misinterpreting it because I'm just getting the quips or the sound bites from. Right. And as someone who I think understands the appreciation of taking time with text and learning that and understanding it, where does that become maybe an issue that we're just not fully living the life because we're just worried about getting enough and then we can move on?
No, this is, I think, important because I think one of the complaints we hear from our academic colleagues is my students don't read. My students don't have the patience to even see through the whole film, right? They only watch segments on YouTube. My kid is 24. And there's many films he's never seen, but there's clips he's seen on YouTube.
Right, and I get enough of it. I know what it's about. Next.
And I think the response that my generation has had to this and generations previous is it's like, oh my God, we got to figure out a way to get a hold of their attention and teach them the importance of, you know, reading all the way through and watching the entire film. And again, I think this might be a losing battle. I think it's important to recognize that, but I think maybe it's time for us to lean into this and say, okay, so we are fast food information culture. How can we teach using that? How can we mobilize that expectation, that limited attention, and be able to deliver material in a way that one speaks to that desire? Because we're not going to get rid of the desire. That desire is there. They want it quick. They want it fast. And they want to drive through experience. They don't want to, you know, sit there for an hour. They want to, you know, 5 minutes and they're out. So what do we do as the deliverers of instructional content to be able to match that sort of expectation? And I think there's things we can do, but it does mean we have to change our delivery mechanism. We can't teach like it's 1965. It just doesn't work anymore. Mm. We have to teach like it's 2025. Or 2035, maybe even thinking that far ahead. Also, I don't think we cultivate the desire for learning more in our students by telling them that you should do this or you should feel guilty mm-hmm. for not doing this. I think we cultivate that curiosity by giving them enough to get them curious in the content. So I'll just give you examples of how I've done this in my own class. I used to assign very long pieces of reading because I write, and I figure they should read. But I recognize that, no, they're not reading. And instead of making them or expecting them to read these long texts outside my classroom, I realized that the better way to do this is to read two pages in the classroom with them together. Now, this is absolutely insane from the previous model of education, which said mm-hmm. you come to class prepared with the readings to talk about the readings. I flipped it. I say, come to class, we'll read some stuff. And after we read some stuff, I'll give you some links to places you might want to go if you want to discover more, if you're curious about it. Some are, some aren't. But if I reach, 30% one day, 25% another day, 50% another day, eventually it adds up where everybody gets something that makes them curious. And I think if it genuinely comes from them, their desire to want to know more about something, for whatever reason, they want to win an argument, they want to look smart, they just want to know more, whatever it is, I think we got to leverage that. We got to say, you're expressing curiosity about this. Let's cultivate the curiosity.
I got goosebumps on that one because I myself end up working with students a lot of times, and it's very easy to be like, well, this is what you should do. This will help you. Like, go do that. And then you're like, I didn't do that. And I'm like, what is wrong? Like, I don't know how else to help you. Do what I tell you. And that is especially as you have more access to it. I think of it a lot of times when people are pursuing the different areas of the arts that they'll just jump in and do it without, like, you've never read Shakespeare, but you're doing poetry and you're doing hip hop music. And you're like, yeah, I don't need to read Shakespeare to do that. I'm just doing it. And it's really kind of empowering to see, but then you're like, I don't know if I'm doing anything. I'm not jumping into those deep ends like they are with no fear. And it's interesting to kind of see. I know we're getting to the point, and we've used up a lot of your time and a lot of your brain power.
I just want to say one thing. This doesn't come from me. It comes from a colleague. He had a student who was really good at rhyme and really good mm-hmm. at developing, rap, and he had this exact experience. He's like, you must have read Shakespeare in high school. And the kid's like, no, I never read Shakespeare. I have no idea what that is. And so my colleague shows him Shakespeare, shows him iambic pentameter. And the kid's like, oh, shit.
I've been doing that all along.
This guy was doing this before me. And then he starts reading Shakespeare. Now, does he read Hamlet all the way through? Probably not. He reads a soliloquy here or there, but he's, learning something about Shakespeare from his own culture, experience, background. And, we did not lead him there. We opened the door and he walked in based on his own interests.
I absolutely enjoy that way of framing learning, because I think a lot of times it's been perceived as a calling or something that you just have to go do and you need to show up to it. But instead of saying, no, we're inviting you into this and to see where it goes. Like I mentioned, I know we're using up a lot of time, and I'm going to give you one a little bit of a challenging question here. But know that you can abstain from the answer. But is there a type of media that you, as someone, again, who delves into a lot of it, that you personally just don't like? Or is there ones that other people don't like and you're like, it should be given more credit or credo to? Maybe that's a better way. That's a more positive way to put it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really interesting question. I guess if I had to say, I'm not going to say don't like. I'll say don't appreciate the way I probably should.
Uh-huh.
For some reason, I don't appreciate ceramics the way I should.
Okay.
I know they're really important. And I know the history of ceramic making and all that is really crucial to human culture. And, we collect the shards of old pottery from the ancients and things like this and display it in the museums. And I know there's a lot going on there. And I know there's reasons why the shapes are the way they are. And people tell me, I have a brother-in-law who's very much into this stuff. He's he's an archaeologist. And when he talks about it, I'm like, okay, I'm talking about pottery again. And I probably should want to know more about it. And I probably should be more curious about it, but that just hasn't happened for me yet.
Thank you. That was exactly what I was looking for. I think sometimes we hold people like yourselves in high esteem, as we should, but also like you're still human and you don't know absolutely everything. And there's things that you're like, that doesn't connect with me, but it doesn't mean I still don't need to go learn and pursue the life improvement. So David, Dr. Gunkel, thank you so much for being here today. This has been an eye-opening conversation, as always. And I just really wish you the best, and I thank you for your time.
Thanks. No, it was really fun talking with you guys.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by Northern Illinois University, where your future is our focus. And please, remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.